So our next speaker is Cheryl Kovar from North Carolina.
Well, thank you. First off, I'd like to thank ASTDA for allowing me this opportunity. Second, to congratulate and really love the first two presenters. I just love research. And third, thank you for calling me a young investigator. You make me feel very good this morning.
We're all young that do this.
That's right. Because I won't tell you that my oldest son has just turned 35 today. So I don't know how that happened. I'm only 42, but it happens.
Wait until he passes you.
That could happen. It could, because I'm not getting any older. No, I'm really excited to be able to present this today. This, too, was part of another study. See, I don't have enough room up here. A portion of a larger study, and we certainly look forward to sharing. The data for the presentation are from a mixed method study that was made possible from a grant through the Federal HIV Prevention Program grant through North Carolina DHHS to East Carolina University College of Nursing, where I am employed. The grant has been funded since 2015 and is conducted through a program that we lovingly call BillCore Pro, Billing, Coding, and Reimbursement Project. Research protocol was reviewed from the ECU's internal review board, and all authors on the paper have no conflict of interest to report. The background, again, I'm preaching to the choir. You all have seen these data. We know STDs are a major concern in our country. We know it costs us a lot of money. I can't get my head around $16 billion in direct care, but that is a lot. North Carolina, we in North Carolina have a special legislative mandate. I must share, I did move to North Carolina in 2007. I am a Buckeye. Moved from Ohio, and in Ohio we did not have this legislation. So when I started to work at the health departments, when they made this comment about that they cannot charge a patient for STD services, I looked at them and said, what? Sure enough, we have an administrative code that states local health departments must diagnose, treat, test, follow up, and provide preventive services for syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and some others. The services, this is the kicker, these services shall be provided upon request and at no charge to the patient. So you can imagine in our health departments in North Carolina the strain that is in, and especially today with funding going down, federal funding going down, local funding, everything's going down, we really need to look at other revenues and streams. Currently, health departments or districts may bill governmental or non-governmental providers for STD services, and certainly we have been billing Medicaid, but billing non-Medicaid or private insurance providers is really a new concept. We have a few that we're starting to bill, but many are not. And finally, screening, reimbursement of STDs, and collaboration amongst health departments, federally qualified health centers, and emergency departments are paramount to public health interventions. This was a qualitative study that was performed with staff from 25 Eastern North Carolina health departments/districts, as well as 13 FQHCs and two emergency departments that represented 33 counties in Eastern North Carolina. The face-to-face interviews were conducted between September 1st, 2015 to January 29th by a member of the research team. Collazi's procedural steps of analysis was used to extract, organize, and analyze the data for central themes. And we interviewed a total of 133 members from these three entities. In regards to our findings, when we looked over our sample, directors of nursing comprised the largest portion with 24 or 18%. Billing, coding supervisors were next with 16.5%. Clinical service managers were 13.5%. And I was very interested as a provider myself. I wanted to see who were the providers. And we had an MD, or several MDs, and FMPs, no PAs, were in this study or were interviewed for a total of almost 7%. We had three themes. The central themes emerged from those three questions: screening, reimbursement, and collaboration. In regards to barriers to screening, some subcategories fell out. First was limits to screening. And I'm going to put my glasses on again, bear in mind, with the three entities, I wanted to get this because these are really rich data, and the word, the voice that we heard through these interviews, again, were so relevant. Emergency departments, when we asked about limits to screening, they reported limited screening based on signs and symptoms only. So if a patient came in, was in the age range under 25, the STD guidelines for chlamydia, gonorrhea, they didn't do a sexual history. They took, so unless they had signs and symptoms or were a known exposure, EDs did not deal with STD screening. FQHCs, on the other hand, verbalized they needed to have advertising of their STD services because patients weren't aware, and I like the term also, clients were not aware of their services. And then local health departments really came through loud and clear. Expedited partner therapy. They just felt they had the lack or limited to that partner treatment. And it comes through in another category, but that was very loud and clear. The second one was insurance woes. Insurance woes, FQHCs often reported that EDs sent their patients to the FQHC if they did not have insurance. Or a private primary care provider. Confidentiality with the EOB was big across FQHCs and ED, or local health departments. Again, not as much in an emergency department, but that was loud and clear for the other two. Patient factors. We all know our patients. This is complex. Emergency departments, they noted they really did agree. They recognized they had a lack of patient follow-up. They would frequently refer to the local health department if they did test and find a positive. The in eastern North Carolina, we're a coastal community in many of our counties, and that was a factor. We had tourists. People coming in for episodic care to both local health departments and FQHCs, and then when the test came back positive, trying to find them again. So that was a really major issue. Local health departments again came out with that lack of tracking, the contact cards, the frustration of trying to get the clients to give them the cards or give. We are approved for EPT in North Carolina, but it is, again, a concept that's not widely used for reasons that we've heard here in the conference. And then also, as we all know, I hate the word noncompliance, but that is the word that was used in the interview. So as a researcher, I'm going to give you the word back. But I like the word non-adherence better. Transportation. Excuse me. Eastern North Carolina is very rural. So transportation is an issue, and I know many of us in this room, we don't have buses. We don't have a train that you can hop on or the MARTA and get to a clinic. They have to find someone who can drive them to a health department. Loss to follow-up, and then finally, patient factors of stigma. Barriers to reimbursement were issues with coding. Very few had certified professional coders in the local health departments or FQHCs. Insurance contracts, as you would not be surprised again, a lot of it was delayed reimbursement, affordable care. Patients have or clients have 3 months grace period on their insurance plans. So if they don't pay their premium, it shows up they have it, but then when you go to bill, they do not pay. And then finally, the sliding fee scale is problematic for some of our health departments and FQHCs. Barriers to collaboration, that was a very, because again, we know we have to work together. Relationships were found to be both positive and some negative, but overwhelmingly more positive. They all had said that we need to know more about what others do. Even though you're in the same county, there was that lack of knowledge. And finally, time and systems constraints. As we know, emergency departments are in, they're open at 2 a.m. and on the weekends and holidays, FQHCs and local health departments are not. So again, discussion. This, to our knowledge, was the first study to identify perceived barriers to screening, reimbursement collaboration among these. We know we need to have a better understanding before we develop interventions and move forward. And this was also looking from a systems perspective versus a clinical perspective, that we need to look at contract issues and those confidential EOBs for strategies. We know, and our hope is, providers can increase their efforts in addressing these barriers and improve STI, HIV services. And then it's opened the dialogue for and presented possibilities for collaboration among these three entities. I'd like to acknowledge again, these as the other presenters, this is not done in a vacuum. These individuals would, if I didn't have their help, would not have been able to do this. As you can see, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, Communicable Disease Branch, and then East Carolina University College of Nursing and my staff. Thank you.
So thank you to all the speakers. We have about 15 minutes for our panel to wax poetic. Oh, you don't have a microphone.
Now you do.
I don't know if it's on.
Great. Thank you all for those presentations. They were so varied, and I think they really highlight this idea that so much important work is being done, and it comes out of reasons behind these sorts of analyses are really coming out of different, for different purposes. I feel like a lot of times we are just sitting at our desks and responding to data requests from either people within our programs wanting to know about the our performance, from folks in academia needing data for grants, and from other outside entities. And you know, you crunch these numbers, you respond to the requests. And in fact, there's really valuable data that can be translated into publication and into presentation. And I think it was really very also nice to see that these were all posters that became presentations this way. I feel also when you submit abstracts to conferences, you know, it's awesome when you get an oral. It's great when you get a poster, but sometimes when you get a poster, there's also this little bit of a feeling that it takes a lot of work to put together a poster, and then you stand in a very large room, and, you know, people pass you, and you try to engage with them, but, you know, sometimes it just doesn't feel the same. But you've done all of this work, and it lends itself, again, to just putting it together on paper and publishing. So those are two things I kind of thought of. One thing also that maybe taking a step back, I feel it's really important to have leadership, and this is not always in any individual's control, but to have leadership that really believes in data to drive decisions and to have that kind of support. We're lucky in New York City that we have that in Dr. Susan Blank. And if you are lucky to have folks around you, leadership that really support junior staff to do analyses and to carve out the time to write, really take advantage of that. You know, I feel like people in academia maybe have a little bit more of an advantage. In busy health departments, we're all just trying to go about our missions of improving the health of the residents in our jurisdictions. But if you've got people in your immediate vicinity who you know would support your desire to do these sorts of things, to do analyses and to write, approach them, try to carve out time with them to talk about your ambitions to do these sorts of things and what kind of support you need to get it done.
Well, Preeti stole most of what I was going to say, but I definitely want to reiterate it's very easy to get lost in all the day-to-day stuff, but it's very important to take the work you've done to publication, simply because you're not the only person trying to do that work. And the lessons you have learned help others down the road so much. Just, you know, some of the examples, looking at the matching algorithm that you were using for Indiana, we are all sitting here trying to match large data systems together that have never been matched. And even just a simple publication on the matching algorithm that you've done would help so many of your collaborators down the road and be useful. And, you know, when I'm looking at for New York City, the rapid syphilis test has been one of those scary things for me, as I think more of our community-based organizations picking it up and using it. And do we actually get the follow-up for the patients? And knowing the outcomes for that syphilis test, I would, you know, love to be able to tell my community-based organizations, see, look what happened when they used this in New York City, because I'm worried that this is, you know, some of the things you need to have thought of before you begin implementing this test. And everybody is scared of EOBs. And billing, number one reason of why, you know, billing doesn't occur, because an EOB is going to go home to the parent. So I think everything here is stuff that we are all dealing with, and taking it to the next level of getting it published is, it's necessary, it needs to happen. And finding that time, you will find support from your organization, because everybody wants to have the publications, because it reflects well on the program. And that's something to know, that you will find somebody who will give you that support.
Yeah, just basically ditto. Thank you. From the perspective of our association, the American SD Association, you know, in our mission, basically, is the dissemination of knowledge that sort of furthers the field of STD prevention, and hence the importance of our journal as one main conduit of sharing that information in the community. As well as the work that we do with conferences. And there are other platforms of disseminating information. And I think it's really important that we realize that what's coming out of local programs is not something that is necessarily only limited, of limited use to that program. There are methods, as we learned this morning, or there are findings, like with the syphilis health check, that are very important to everybody, because the whole world is looking at these tests and these methods as something that they, you know, are interested in, and to have the opportunity to learn about other programs, what they're finding, is something that is of critical importance to us. So I would actually like to ask Bill to perhaps give us a little bit of insight of what the journal can do, in addition to what it already does, in furthering and in stimulating this type of work. And then we'll turn it over.
Thanks. So I think a couple things. One, the first thing to recognize is that there's different formats for publication. So you may have, from your program, just a simple, small finding that's particularly important, but maybe it's not worth a whole paper. So we do take things like letters to the editor, where you can just describe it, and the bar is relatively low for that publication. We don't take a lot of those, in part because we don't get a lot of them, but also because you just want to make sure that you can convey what you need to convey in that small space. And then there's also what's called a research note, which is 1,500 words, which is not very long, and so sometimes it's that's enough space to tell the story that you need to tell. So, and then there's a full research paper, which is 3,500 words or so. So if you have an idea for a paper, if you have if you've done something beyond the norm, we already have, you know, many health departments across the country that have sort of a culture of publication. And those are often the health departments that you all in program will sort of look to for leadership generally. And so one way to start is actually to look at models of other papers that are not necessarily exactly what you did, but something similar to what you did as a model for that paper. The things that we can do as a journal to help you include things like, you can contact us early in the process and say, would you be interested in something like this? Most of the time, my answer to that is sure. It's relatively rare that I turn something away at that stage because it's hard to know how it's going to develop. And generally, I feel like my job is to encourage people to move things along rather than discourage them to move things along. If you're at that stage and you really don't know how to go about doing it, then include in that email a question of, is there someone that you could that could help us do this? And one of the things that I love about doing STD work is that it's a very generous community as a whole. And so we can generally, I anticipate, without too much trouble, identify someone who has experience in the area that you're trying to work in, who will help you move it along. And that may come from our editorial board, it may come from someone that one of us knows in that area, it may come from maybe it'll be Kyle.
Let's put him on the spot.
who's done this a few times along the way in his career. So we will help you find someone. The other thing I would say is, if you've gone all the way through to the point of getting it submitted, getting it ready to submit for publication, be sure in the very beginning of your, there's a place where you have a little cover letter in that submission. In the very beginning of the cover letter, make it clear that this is program, and especially if it doesn't quite fit a typical research article, make it clear in that beginning that it's not really a regular research article. Because then that helps me and the other editors assign it more appropriately to the appropriate reviewers. Because sometimes a sort of, for lack of a better term, and no offense please, a softer paper about program doesn't need or shouldn't have sort of the kind of review that we give to a full sort of full impact, you know, randomized clinical trial kind of thing. So a little heads up for that can be quite helpful. I think that's most of the points I was going to make. I'm open for questions. I'm going to let Case plug the real world.
Yeah, so that's been one of the sort of earlier efforts in furthering this particular thinking for the journal is, I think it's now 3 years ago that we developed a section in the journal called The Real World of STD Prevention, where we're really trying to explore what's happening sort of at the interface of program and science, and is part of sort of the program science portfolio within the journal. The nice thing about it is that if you get published in that particular section, that this is it's not open access, but it's freely accessible. So for people that do not subscribe to the journal, they can actually download these papers without cost, and so that makes it pretty attractive. And so we get actually some folks that request that if their paper gets accepted, that it be published in this particular section of the journal. So so thank you for that plug. Yeah, it's near and dear to my heart.
Are there any other questions from the group?
Yes.
Hello.
Oh,
Jeff.
Jeff Stover in Virginia. So thanks so much for putting this together. I think it's great to have a session for young investigators. But I wanted to put a plug in really for this journal, because I think in addition to just the program science aspects, I'm not an avid reader of all of the literature, so just having said that, but I do read this journal. And it was like 2007, I think, when Kevin Fenton, for those who've been around, Kevin Fenton used to be the director of the National Center, when he actually put an editorial in from one of Matt Golden's papers about the courage to learn from our failures. And I don't think we do that enough. And I think about new folks who are in the field that, you know, publishing things that didn't work is a good thing. And we just don't do that enough. And, you know, Kevin wrote a really good paper or editorial that you guys published about that. And I think that was still like 9 years ago, and we still don't see a lot of that. Everyone thinks they have to publish the things that were really, really good. and not the things that didn't do as well, and I think we really need to be doing both. So
yeah.
Just wanting to encourage those new people to do that.
Well, and I think in that context, especially programmatically, one of the key things that can be that makes it very publishable is if you look very carefully at why it didn't work or what seems to be why it didn't work. It's a lot harder to publish something that just says it didn't work versus something that says it didn't work and we looked at it and these are some of the reasons why. So if you try this, make sure you take into account these things. It's a little bit like the barriers kind of aspect here. But I totally agree. The tendency is to think, well, this was great, so I'm going to publish it, and not this didn't really go very well, so I'm going to publish it. We tend not to have that second thought. Any other questions? Well, thank you everybody for coming, and let's thank our panel and our speakers.